which is slightly related to the previous subject. Most of us, when obsessive, repetitive, stalking thoughts arise in our mind, we have only a limited behavioral vocabulary of ways to deal with these obsessive visitors, these persistent ideations in the mind. Look at my wonderful vocabulary, which my parents paid a lot of money to provide me with. Actually, they didn't. I went to a lot of open schools, but anyway, where was I? Persistent visitors in the mind. So, how do we relate to them? Most of us have a limited vocabulary of dealing with them, which is sometimes we sit and listen to what these obsessive, repetitive thoughts have to say. Like, you know, somebody who's on a street corner yelling and shouting, we stand and actually listen as they scream in our minds that the world, our world's going to end. We've blown it this time. The future's bleaker than we thought. Our financial foundations are shot, or whatever. Whatever repetitive thoughts have to say. Sometimes we listen, and it does us often little good. And yet, because they're in our minds, these thoughts often have us held captive. They can be very loud. Second way we relate to them is by, if they become too horrific, often we will distract ourselves with external dramas to try to get away from the fears in our minds. Sometimes we'll turn on the television set or get wrapped up in the events of work or the world or relationships. We can get completely... I've seen people who get obsessively driven into trying to be in a relationship as a way to escape the fact that they're overwhelmed by graduating from school or being in a new city or whatever. We try to find something to distract the mind away from the real issue, which is that we've got a mind that's being visited by fear or stories of the past, unpleasant memories. Another way that people try to deal with their obsessive visitors is by numbing it, getting rid of it through alcohol, drugs, pushing food at it, anything to try to quiet the voices. There are, of course, some skillful ways to relate to these obsessive visitors, these repetitive, repeating voices in the mind. That's what the Buddha offered with such strategies as Dhammavikaya, Yonisamanasikara, Satisampujana. There's so many words and ideas he attached to it, but basically it all boils down to rather than indulging the voices and believing and letting the voices carry us away into dire imaginary lands, whisk us away, what's known as dissociative episodes, where we're no longer even aware of where we are, what we're doing, how the body feels. Suddenly we're in this imaginary other world. It's funny, as the monk Ajahn Jeff says, most of us from a very young age are taught by our parents, you know, not to get into a car with strangers that say, "Hey, get in, kid. I'll take you someplace interesting." yet most of us, when our thoughts pop into our mind pronouncing that the end is nigh, we'll get right in there with that thought. Say, yeah, show me. Tell me how I've blown it. I really want to hear this. Take me anywhere. If only our parents had said, yeah, by the way, not only strangers in cars, but strange thoughts that tell you you suck or you're a failure, don't get in the car with those thoughts either. If only they taught us that. But whatever. So they don't. The Buddha actually did teach his son Rahula that. There's a wonderful sutta where he does just that. But so the key is detachment. It's not indulging the thoughts. It's not diverting ourselves away from them with diversions that only work for a while and cause stress in and of themselves. The dramas and work and families do that. Or it's not drinking and numbing ourselves, which really doesn't work because the thoughts are back at us the moment drugs or alcohol wears away and or the high of spending money or whatever. So we develop a new transformed relationship, detachment, which basically involves viewing the thoughts from a distance, from not right up on top of them inside the mind, but rather from an entirely new perspective. The first part of detachment is we have to develop some form of regular meditation practice. As Kate was saying, there's a lot of good fMRI-based studies that show that the more we meditate, the less the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that causes stress response and fear, based states, the less it fires. And when the amygdala fires less, there's much less cortisol present in the brain, much less adrenaline. And so the thoughts that do arise are much less sticky for us. They're much less shouted from a bullhorn in our brain saying, pay attention to me. Because the underpinnings of cortisol and stress that's accompanying them is not present. So that the thoughts in and of themselves are just much less bombarding and loud and sticky, and they have much less mental emphasis behind them. They're not in bold copy. So that in itself allows us to transform our relationships with thoughts. The more we have a meditation practice, the less stress, the less our thoughts are... have this urgent quality to them. I guarantee you, though, if your house really is on fire, you'll know it. It's not like you're going to suddenly miss really important cues. The second part of developing detachment is keeping part of the awareness mindfully anchored in body and breath sensations. When you've got at least part of your awareness aware of how your body is feeling, when you're not viewing thoughts up in your mind entirely, but you've got some awareness of how your stomach feels or your shoulders or your jaw or just how your body is relating to what arises as thoughts. This gives us something that keeps us, it's like having one foot out the door. You always have one foot outside of those thoughts. There's always this escape hatch you've got. Because if you start seeing the body get really, really contracted and tight, if you see the area where you hold your fear, in my case, my stomach, my anxieties are in my shoulders, and my anger is often in my jaw. So I know where different emotions play out. And I'm trying constantly throughout the day just to have some awareness of the embodied or what's known as somatic state that's underpinning my thoughts. So this gives me also detachment. Another way the Buddha taught, a third strategy, is to balance the sense awareness so that sometimes if we are just too uncomfortable in the body, there's too much tension, and the thought is really yelling, really predicting dire outcomes from us, we're really in fear, you know, where we have something that won't let us go, sometimes simply focusing on keeping the mind open to all the senses that are coming in, whether it's sight or sounds or aromas or whatever, this just in and of itself can keep the mind spacious enough that the thought is less loud. For example, if your mind's only this big, if you've got no awareness of what's going on around you, and you've got no awareness of the body, then a thought's going to be very loud. But if we open up our awareness so that we've brought in awareness of other senses, what's going, you know, what the sounds are at any given moment, the sensation of the body making contact with the floor, and other internal sensations like how the stomach feels, how the breath feels, then a thought makes much less sound because awareness is so much bigger. There's the vessel of awareness is so much larger that the repetitive, obsessive, fear-based, self-centered thoughts don't really have the same volume and stickiness to them. Let's see what if I'm okay. Finally, of course, Buddha also talked about, and everybody should know about this, the obviousness of sharing, having somebody that we trust that we can share about even the most primal fears that we generally don't share about, or the stuff that feels the most personal. It's this feeling that something is ours and uniquely mine that can make them these thoughts the most difficult to work with, because we really believe, oh, this is my thought, this is really who I am, this thoughts, I produce this thought, it's you know, a product of my mind, therefore I have to take it seriously. And it's only when we articulate it, A, that we hear from other people, oh yeah, I think that all the time. And when you hear that, you're like, huh? Oh. Then that changes our relationship to the thought. And sometimes, too, just the act of sharing aloud a fear or an obsessive worry can utterly transform our relationship with it. As an example I give often, when I was, many, many years ago, when I was at one of my first jobs that had any... that I took any sense of pride in. I was at this job, and it had been a very, very long time I was there, and I hadn't asked for any time off, any vacation. And there was this fear that started up in my mind that if I asked for time off, that my boss would realize how little work I was doing, or how good the work I was doing, I suppose. And then the thought went on to tell me that my boss would then fire me, and then the thought went on to tell me I'd never get another job. Then the voice went on to tell me that because I never would get another job, I'd be, well, I was actually living in a squat at the time, but I still would be kicked out, and I have no money, and then I'd wind up being killed as a homeless person on the street by roving knife-wielding gangs. So asking for a vacation became a life-threatening endeavor in my mind. If I asked for a vacation, I was putting my life at risk. And it was only when I explained this to a friend that I heard the words coming out that I was like, oh my God, you know, I've got a crazy person in there, and I'm listening to it. I'm indulging this voice of, you're going to die if you ask for a little time off. But it's very often the same voice that has us, when we need a day off from work, not tell the truth. We feel we don't have the permission to just say, hey, I need a break. Some of us will come up with excuses, you know, rather than simply say, hey, you know, I just need a day off. So yeah, it's really, really important to share about it with someone. If you can't find someone to share about it, I've found sometimes just writing it out in a journal sometimes and then coming back. Make sure we don't edit it when we write it. Just let it all out. Sometimes when you're letting it out, you're like, oh, really? But then coming back sometimes, then we see, wow, this is not something that I should really be listening to. These are all strategies for detachment. One of my favorite, though, I wanted to talk a little bit more in depth about is the Buddha's strategies on externalizing inner voices. And this means we view each thought in our mind as a visitor from the outside. We don't view thoughts as a product or uniquely ours. We view thoughts as something that are transpersonal. If you've ever read Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene, there's a whole study of this called memes, which basically establishes that thoughts are basically little ideas that float from one mind to another, one person to another. They're transmitted in words and in television and in radio, and they're transcultural. If you don't believe Richard Dawkins, the philosopher Michel Foucault taught the same things with epistemes, and Bertrand Russell established the same thing. And basically the idea is that ideas are just floating out there. And all we do, the mind is simply basically an imitation machine. It hears it, it copies it, and then it slaps a new coat of paint on these ideas by putting them in our own words. And because they arise in our own words and in our minds, we think, that idea was my idea. That thought is my thought. Well, it's not. The thoughts of, wow, I've blown it, or how am I going to have enough money, or what's going to happen to me, or reasons why, you know, you suck, or I suck, or the world sucks, or Exxon sucks, or whatever. They all come from outside, and then they wind up inside the mind. So once we realize this, or we get an inkling of this, we can start externalizing the voices. We do this by, first of all, when a voice is in our mind that's repeating, I ask myself, if somebody else was telling me this, would I believe them? If somebody else was constantly following me around saying, you've really blown it, or, you know, you're not going to be able to pay your taxes, over and over and over again. you really should call that person, but you really don't want to, just reminding me over and over and over again. I really wouldn't think that person's a friend. And once I realize that the voice in my head is not a friendly voice, then I can view it with a little bit more suspicion. Because just reflecting on, hey, wait a second, I would never allow somebody to tell me what this voice is telling me as often as this voice is telling me it. Or I can ask myself conversely, would I treat a friend this way, the way I'm treating myself? Would I tell somebody else over and over and over again that they're really out of shape and that they should exercise more often? Or that, oh my God, look how ridiculous your body looks. I don't think I would follow any friend around and tell them that, but that's often the first thought I have in the morning. So externalizing can take that form. Some other techniques the Buddha recommended was asking ourselves, Is this thought something that I would feel comfortable having broadcasted out? And when you think about it, really, why would I want to have a lot of thoughts in my mind that I'm too ashamed of, that I would want nobody to ever be able to hear? If I really think, well, you know, it's okay that inside my mind is all this judgment of myself and other people, all this, you know, bitter, you know, commentary on what other people are saying. If I think that's okay just to have it in here, but I wouldn't feel uncomfortable with other people hearing it, we should bear in mind that neuroscientists show us that neurons that fire together wire together. If I think very dark, critical, bitter thoughts in my mind, I'm hardwiring that commentary into my brain. I'm literally beginning to weld the neurons together. And those voices, if I'm turning them on other people, they're not going to just stay on other people. They're actually going to turn on me. I'm going to be the recipient of them. If I'm constantly praising myself at the expense of others, that voice is going to turn backwards on me and start comparing me negatively. I can't have any voice in my mind without it eventually taking its toll on me. And eventually it'll take its toll on people I love as well. I can't be compartmentalized with anything. I'd like to believe it, but every hard evidence I've seen shows that the more we give attention to thoughts, the likelier they will repeat themselves more often. That's what pretty much we know for a fact. So it's really important to ask, when a thought is visiting us constantly, is this really the kind of mind that I want to live in the future? Do I want this type of thought to be growing in my mind? That's what the Buddha called karma. Karma is any thought or action we intentionally give authorship to that can plant the seeds for it to grow again in the future and create the mind that we live in. So I asked myself, is this a thought I really want to plant, that I really want to neurally wire into my mind? Another thought the Buddha often talked about is that we are mortal beings, and none of us have guarantees for any lasting futures. We're all here at the benefit of bodies that at any time, though, can, for any number of different internal reasons, stop working. And it's worthwhile asking, is this the last thought that I would want to have in my mind? It's one of the Buddha's well-known quotes that he would tell his students. Would you want this to be your last thought? And in the time of the Buddha, the last thought you had, it was said, would influence your future incarnation. Now, even if you don't believe in rebirth, which is fine, I'm very skeptical towards it. If you do believe in it, that's a good reason to, hey, is this thought the last one? Because this is going to determine whether I wind up a frog or an angelic being. It plays a big role. Actually, you read some of the teachings, and it's the last thought plays a. It's like they. Some people say it's the spin on the when you're playing pool and you put spin on the cue ball, and it that's the thing that puts the last final determination on rebirth. But even if you don't, it's worthwhile remembering just the fact that each thought can have on our future mind state. It's really important to keep our suspicious minds towards the inner yes men we all have. These are the voices of self-justification that immediately jump up and justify everything we do, no matter how questionable. Well, I've had for years to be able to pay the bills. I've worked freelance at big corporations, just designing stuff. And I try to work as little as possible, but sometimes I get sucked in there. And then one of the things I would do to get even with them for exploiting me was I would inevitably come home with a new pen. At the end of it, say, where did you come from? And then that voice in my head say, well, screw them. Screw that fucking company. They're not paying me anywhere near what I'm worth, and they're exploiting us, and they're making a fortune, and I'm just a worker bee, blah, 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 blah. And I listen to this voice immediately justify everything, really completely for a long time, unaware that these are the voices that lead us to despair. If you look at it, like virtually every single rich and famous person who's met an untimely end has met their untimely end because they were surrounded by yes men who said yes to every stupid thing they did, including drugs, you know, intoxicants, risky business endeavors, hanging around with bad, violent people. If you've got a yes person around them, or you, that says yes to everything you do, this is not a friend. This is not a friendly voice. This is not a voice to follow. The voice that says, you're wonderful no matter what it is you're doing. Now, that doesn't mean, on the other hand, we want to listen to the voices that are endlessly critical either. We want to, in fact, find the wise voices in our minds. Meditation is not just about discerning which are the unskillful voices. We all have skillful voices in our minds. None of us would be here meditating, which is not easy, if we didn't have skillful voices in our minds. Skillful voices have a lot of characteristics in common if you want to know who they are. The first is they generally don't tend to repeat themselves all the fucking time. I've had many skillful thoughts, and those fuckers only come up once. I'll say, maybe, you know, maybe you should call blah, blah, blah. And that's it. That's it. They go away. Then the rest of it's like, fuck that. You know, I don't want to call anyone. I just want to hang out and watch Breaking Bad one more episode. So, the voice that just mentions itself humbly once and doesn't berate us, doesn't shout, that just quietly says, hey, maybe it would be a good idea if I donated that coat rather than keep it, even though I haven't worn it for 2 years. Still, I might one day wear it. Even though I hate the way I look in that coat. So I try to follow that voice that just appears once. I found that the voices that are less to do with our sheer survival and more to do with generosity and virtue and peacefulness generally don't tend to shout, repeat themselves, threaten us with bad outcomes if we don't follow us or follow them and do exactly what they say. They just generally tend to speak once, humbly offer an idea, and they go away. It's really important to really be very thankful for having them and reward them by really focusing on, I'm glad that voice that told me to do that was there. I'm glad that I have this part of my mind that's not just in it for the immediate short-term results, doesn't matter what the cost is, but that I have a part of the mind that is looking out for my best interests and other people's best interests in the long term. So it's really important to reflect what the Buddha called Kaga Nusati, Sila Nusati. Just sit and just feel good about the fact we have skillful voices in our minds and that we've acted out skillfully upon these endeavors. Really, really develop the process of rewarding ourselves for anything virtuous we do. If we try to do something virtuous and then depend upon other people's recognition for the fact we've done good, we're making our rewards contingent upon something we have no control over. If I need you, and I have, you know, to say, oh, you're a great person because you held the elevator door open, most of the time you're going to go, yeah. Even if I've done something really worthy, hey, I went on this site for such and such, and I gave money to this organization that's really useful. If I'm making myself rewarded for that by needing you to know that, I'm making my sense of esteem very contingent. And in fact, there was a wonderful study that showed did a study with students where they gave half of them. They gave all the students a certain amount of money. I think it was $10, and they told half to spend it on themselves and half to spend it on someone else. They went back 6 months later, and the ones that had spent it on themselves couldn't remember what they bought with the $10, had no additional values of, feelings of merit or esteem or inner worthiness. The people 6 months later who spent the $10 on other people could remember who it was they gave the money to, why they chose that person, and still felt good about it. And part of the process of feeling good about it is that they reflected on it. they often brought it to mind. And that's what encourages and gives power to these skillful voices in the mind. It's not so much getting recognition from other people. It's being able to sit and feel really in touch with the actions that we've undertaken that are the results of these voices. To really also just feel good that we've cultivated in our mind, against all odds, voices that are not just in it for our own survival. This is a uniquely often human characteristic, that we can do it. And it's really worth being able to reflect on that. So I think that I'm going to leave it there with my talk on how to detach from thoughts. In summary, have some form of a practice. Keep body awareness. Remember to externalize the voices and ask if, and put personalities to them and see if this is somebody we would trust. View them with suspicion and share about them. So I thank you for listening. I hope there was something of value tonight, and now it's your turn to ask any questions or share any experiences that have to do with spiritual practice. And thank you for joining Dharma Punks.